Good evening and welcome to the North Oakland Speaker Meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Marissa. I'm an alcoholic and tonight's secretary. Please turn off your cell phones. Please help me to open the meeting with a moment of silence followed by the serenity prayer. God,
grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We're fully self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. All right, this is a speaker meeting. I will speak for 10 minutes and then turn the meeting over to our main speaker, Roger, who will share his experience, strength, and hope.
My name is Marissa. I'm an alcoholic. I was excited to go to a meeting where I wasn't going to know anyone. I thought I wouldn't be nervous, but I know some of you from San Francisco. My sobriety date is August 4th, 2008, so I have 17 months sober. And I'll try to condense it down to 10 minutes. I grew up in a family of alcoholics. There's a lot of addiction in my family. And I grew up with an alcoholic in my immediate family, my middle brother. So I had a pretty idyllic childhood until I was about seven. And then there was, I'm going to like really condense it. Then there was some violence in my house. And I became like the people pleaser child. I was the quiet one who did good. And my middle brother developed drug addiction and drinking when he was 16. So when I was about 12, so our house was really chaotic. And I also, like in those years, became really depressed and had a severe obsessive compulsive disorder. So I just had a lot of torture going on in my head and in my family. And the way I reacted to that was just controlling everything around me. And I didn't drink in reaction to my brother's drinking. And I was a straight edge kid when I was young. I didn't have my first drink till I was 21. Totally broke my edge when I was 21, which I'm kind of embarrassed about. My 21st birthday, in fact. And I was going to college and a lot of things fell apart in my life at once, and I decided to move to San Francisco to, like, take a break for 3 months. That was 7 years ago. I had not left the city. And that's when I started drinking alcoholically. I moved in with two bartenders, and we just drank all the time. They stole from their work, and we would just go to Safeway and fill a cart with, like, I want to call it economy size, like huge, like party size, but there was no party. Like sometimes we had parties, but we just always had big bottles and always went out drinking. And it was problematic from the start. And I knew it was a problem, and I didn't admit that. I suspected it was a problem. I took an addiction studies class at Berkeley to prove to myself that I was not an alcoholic. And at the time, that was evidence enough because it hadn't gotten bad enough. And I read a lot about like memoirs of other people whose drinking was worse. And I surrounded myself with a lot of cocaine users. And I used coke as well, but because they were always like, "You're so good, you barely do coke." So, because I am the kind of alcoholic who really likes a drunk. Like, I did a lot of drugs. If you offered me drugs, I was going to do them until I realized they were fucking up my drunk. And then I was like, no, I don't want your uppers because then I don't feel drunk. That's just me. I really like to check out. And I really liked the effect it had. I had been in such tight control and so concerned with, like, maintaining everything around me and what people thought of me, like getting just like flying under the radar, that it was such a release to drink and to let go. And I feel like I always had like four linear trains of thought going in my mind, and then suddenly I got tunnel vision. I was so happy to like be able to focus. All I had to focus on was like who I was going home with or how I was getting home and the next drink. Those are like my only concerns. Like somehow get my ass somewhere safe and stay drunk and try to get up and go to work in the morning. And that worked for years. And I got in a really codependent relationship. I lived in Oakland for a year. And I could probably drive from like the apartment I lived in to the job I had at that time. Other than that, I couldn't tell you shit about the city. And I lived here for a year. I just handed the keys over to him, and I was like, "Take care of our lives. Take care of our lives for me." And that's kind of how I lived for years. And I started to have stomach problems, and the reading that Sean read reminded me of that. I called it whiskey gut. My stomach would hurt, it was hemorrhaging. And so I would switch to wine for a month or two and then back to whiskey. And that's actually where that led me to my bottom. I never really wanted to stop drinking. It wasn't sustainable anymore. I came to AA wanting to drink, and I wanted to drink until I had about 9 months sober. I wanted to drink in a bodily way every day. But I was sick and my life had fallen apart. I was fired, I was being evicted. I'd had bed bugs, so I didn't have a bed, so I slept on a hardwood floor for months, sick. And I had been a daily drinker, and at this point I was only able to drink every other day because I was incapacitated. Like my stomach was bleeding. So I was trying to decide what to do, what the solution was, and my old standby was to kill myself. So I was like, okay, I can kill myself. I was like, maybe I should call my mom and have her commit me. Because I was like on the brink of like a psychological break. I was very aware of that. And I was like, I could commit myself. And then I was like, maybe I should just switch to heroin. But that wasn't working out because like all my friends were like cokeheads, and they were like, no, that's not okay. And then I dated a heroin addict, and he moved to New York. He was like, it's so much easier there, and like, to cop. So I was laying on my floor, sick, and deciding, like, trying to decide what to do for, like, a couple days. And I had this, like, overwhelming experience of just sudden, it was like this epiphany, like, I don't want to die. And My way of thinking was to want to die since I was 9 years old. And it was just like something bigger than myself that I understand now as a spiritual experience to want to live. And that brought me to AA. My brother had gotten sober many years before that, I guess about 6 years before that. And it had never occurred to me to go to AA because I never really wanted to stop. I never wanted to live. And suddenly, once I wanted to live, that was an option. And I went to AA the next day, and I just kind of went along with whatever I was told to do. My first meeting, I just remember it was a block away from my house, thank God. And it was a daily meeting, and that was like all I did for a while. At that point, like my routine had been to like get up, shower, walk a block to the bar, stay at the bar until my boyfriend came to get me, bought me lunch with his food stamps, went back to the bar, went home and passed out. And that was like a good day, like if I made it home to pass out, you know? So now my routine was like, get up, shower, go to a meeting, like hang out with people, go to another meeting, fucking get a job, like start rebuilding my life and just kind of do what was suggested. And so I went to meetings, I got a sponsor, and we immediately started the steps. I've had the same sponsor. I haven't relapsed. And she's really big on moving forward, so I really beat myself up about doing the steps the wrong way or feeling like I didn't do them completely. But now I try to bear in mind that you just do them and then you redo them and redo them, and you'll get more out of them each time. I'm just really aware of the time. What do I want to say about that? I feel like early sobriety is kind of a fog for me. Like, I kind of lost my short-term memory, and I was just kind of like on autopilot, doing what seemed to be the next thing. And So I don't really have that much to say about it other than I suggest taking suggestions. And I think a lot of that was just grace. And I feel like my drinking was characterized by like commiserating and feeling like the universe fucked me over, like the joke was on me, like I'm a failure, why can't I get it together? And now I see that like my perspective is sort of like, if I'm not ready to have something, it's not going to come my way. So I have to like get myself ready and just do what's in front of me. And that's carried me through so far. And really kind of just relieve the burden of feeling like a failure or feeling like I'm responsible for everything, good or bad. Yeah, I think I'm going to stop there. I'm grateful to be sober. I like to make a point of saying that that you can stay sober even if you want to drink. I remember when I first came, people saying you don't have to drink ever if you don't want to. And then when I was in for a couple months, someone said, you never have to drink again, even if you want to. And that's what I needed to hear. Because I did want to drink. Like, I know that. My body wants that. Like, I'm an addict, and I find life uncomfortable. But I don't want to die. So if you want to drink, if you can still work this program. Yeah, I'll just end there. Thank you. Now I'd like to turn the meeting over to tonight's speaker, Roger.
Wow. My name is Roger, an alcoholic. I didn't think it would happen that quick. I thought it'd have, there's like a smoke break or something like that. But I'd like to thank the committee for having me here. It's definitely a privilege to be asked to talk at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I sit in a lot of meetings, and oftentimes I think I look across the room and I go, God, I've never heard that person's story before, ever. You know, and I don't know why that is. And by the time the meeting's over, I forget about it, and I just talk to people I know, and I get back into my own self-centered world, and that's how it usually goes a lot of times. I have these moments of when I get out of myself, and they're just moments usually, and I know that they need to last longer than that. So these days, it's you know, I try to think about others more, which, you know, for me that's like the hardest thing to do. And when I first got to Alcoholics Anonymous, it was about drinking, the problems, therefore my life was horrible. And I thought if you just took away this part of the equation, then everything would be fine. And I was one of those where 4.5 months of just going to meetings, that's when things started to become very, very real and they started to get horrible. And I still tried to hang out with people I drank with. I try to drive people to the bar. I'd be the designated driver, you know, I'm the good guy. And that was miserable. That was like the most miserable time. And I had drunk people telling me, one friend in particular, Darren, I remember he just like came up to me and he's just beer all over his, just breathing on me going, you know, I liked you better when you were drinking because you're being an ass right now. Because I wasn't having a good time. I was sitting there, let's go, this place sucks, let's go, let's go. I was a wet blanket. You know, I was the wettest of wet blankets. I was a big downer. I was just ruining everybody's fun. And so there I was. I was caught in between. I was not drinking. I was physically sober as I am right now. But yet I was just miserable. You know. So my problems, you know, is not really alcohol. I mean, alcohol is just a symptom, and my drinking is just a symptom. Really, my problem is my self-centered behavior, and what goes on. That's alcoholism. And I don't. A lot of times, I forget that when I get called on a meeting, and I want to just talk about something great that happened to me, or I just want to complain in the meeting and talk about how and somehow, like I like to call it, milk the udders of self-pity from the meeting. Like maybe if I can win you over by my self-pity, you will be on my side and you'll understand, and I can still be an idiot, and it'll be okay, you know. And as time goes on, the society doesn't really go for that. You know, I've been married 9 years now. My wife doesn't go for that. She just wants me to participate in the relationship and go to work and help pay for the bills and, you know, do laundry once in a while. And her joke is, yeah, the eggs, it's at the same place where they sell milk. You know, so she's hinting that I never go and I never pick up those things on the way home because I'm not thinking about us. Oftentimes thinking about me. I want to get home so I can start checking my emails or get on the internet or start gaming or something. I don't think about us. And that's alcoholism, you know. I have a sobriety date. It's April 13th, 1991. And I haven't felt it necessary to take a drink or drug since then. I don't know why. I sit in meetings with many people who that's not the case. And I don't know why it stuck. I don't know why. I have a sponsor that I talk to on a weekly basis, and that man doesn't put up with anything. He's the kind of guy where he'll just say, I don't even want to complain to him because I just know he's just going to... So I try and streamline what's going on with me. And so I just streamlined, like the other day when I called him, I said, I just streamlined. I go, okay, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? I said, I don't like this guy at work. He bugs the crap out of me. And he's like, well, you have one or two options. You either don't work there anymore, or you just don't let that guy bug the crap out of you. You know, and we go through the steps. He makes sure I know where things are in the book. I can take other men through the book. I know where the steps are. I know about the traditions. And so these days, I appreciate that kind of sponsorship. He just says, okay, you either want to live, you either want to be free or not. You know, you've been sober long enough, you know. I want to just stew on it. I still want to find reasons to hate somebody or to justify it or to find little things to do. Like this person I work with, I don't want to go too deep into it. But I'll just preface the rest of my time up here with I may get emotional, which means I may cry a little bit. I try not to. I don't know how people can go up there and talk about some things they do without even crying. But if I talk about my family or if I talk about amends, and see, I'm starting to choke up right now. Just thinking about it. If I bring up my late sponsor, I'll get choked up. So that may happen. I may get a little emotional. I may throw out my opinion a little bit. I try not to, but things I've seen in the almost 18 and a half years of sobriety, going to meetings and being involved in Alcoholics Anonymous, I see some stuff sometimes that I'm not really sure of. And so sometimes I think at group level, if it just gets aired out a little bit, maybe together we can somehow subconsciously come up with some kind of solution for certain things. There's certain things in AA that we see, that I see, that I just don't really understand. So anyways, those may come out. I'll try to keep those limit on those because then it turns into just as Roger sees it. And really, it's not my program. I'm just one alcoholic, and that's it. The only kind of jail time I ever did was I was in the drunk tank twice. The old Santa Rita jail and the new Santa Rita jail after they remodeled it. And I was just in there with the other drunk guys. That's it. That's my jail time. You know, I'm the kind of guy where I would borrow money off my mom and I would go shoulder tap beer. And then when I turned 21, I would borrow money off my mom and have to, I don't know, after a while I had to like wait, like if a friend was over at the house and I go, and I just wait and pace and kind of pace it out. My mom would just finally just say, well, how much do you want? You know, and she would just get in her wallet and just give me money and then I'd go to the bar. And so that kind of, I didn't really realize how pathetic that was then. As I look back on it now, I got sober at age 23. And just to get some formalities out of the way, I was born in Oakland at Merritt Hospital. I think it's called Peralta now, right? And I grew up in Berkeley until I was two. So I don't know if that's really growing up. I lived here until I was two on Ordway in Berkeley. And my mom would always, she would give me everything. That woman would cut off her fingers for me. And she would cook me any food, no matter how drunk I was when I came home. So age 23, I'm still at home, taking advantage of my parents. And I would do things like people would go, I'd be at the bar and I'd be trying to, you know, make conversation with somebody. And they'd go, where do you live? I live here and I live in a house. Oh, really? I go, well, I live with an older couple. I go, I've known them a while. They're pretty nice, you know, rent's cheap. I didn't pay anything, you know. So I lived like in this lie, and I lived in this lie all the time that I would always smooth it over with sarcasm and humor, And then I would give you a sob story to, I don't know, whatever it may be. Those are the things I always would go to, you know. If I'd pick up on a situation, I'd try to get you with humor or be sarcastic. Or if that wasn't working, then I would try and, you know, get you with the self-pity thing. And that's kind of manipulating. And that's really self-centered. And I didn't really realize those things. Now, if you want to call them defects of character, that's fine. For me these days, I just narrowed down to I'm a self-centered alcoholic. I'm a real alcoholic. The thing is I did drugs too. I sold, I'd get a quarter pound a week of, it was not that good, but it was like Mexican cents. I'd go up to up north and I'd get it for, I don't know why it was called Mexican cents, and I'd go up to this place called Mill Creek up near Mount Lassen to get it. I don't know why he called it Mexican cents. We're pretty far away from Mexico. But I'd go up there and I'd get it once a week and I'd bring it down here and I'd sell it down here and I just, you know, but the thing is I quit doing that on my own. I quit doing coke on my own. I quit doing, at the time they called it crank, and it was either orange, brown, yellow, it was all different kinds of colors, different grain sizes. And I just quit doing that because I get to the point where it's like, I just can't do this. But the thing is I always started with alcohol and I always ended with alcohol. And I know that, you know, just because I did drugs doesn't necessarily make me something else, but even though I didn't do them doesn't mean that I'm not an alcoholic. And I know I'm an alcoholic because once I put alcohol into my body, something happens. Something happens. It's like this hunger I just can't satisfy. I will go anywhere. I will say anything. I will do anything to get more. And usually that's when the drugs would start, is because I would, 2:30 in the morning, I'm at the ATM machine just tapping out everything and ready to continue. You go buy other stuff to mix it with. And, so, like I said, something else may get thrown out there, and I'll try and keep the focus on what my experience, strength, and hope is and what happened to me. Like I said, I got sober on April 13th, 1991. It was at a fellowship in, little east of here. And that was strange because there was a lot of old people there. And you could smoke, and I smoked at the time, and I just thought, after a couple weeks in, I'm thinking, is this it? Is this AA for me? Is this what my life is about now? I'm going to sit in this room with this, brown, yellow walls and drink coffee out of where they could never wash the lipstick off of the cups, or they would smell like bleach. I just thought, God, is this it for me? And then I really wasn't totally sure if I was an alcoholic or not, because I really didn't know what that meant. I didn't really know what alcoholism was. I really didn't know what an alcoholic was. In our book, it talks about, I can't tell the truth from the false, that I have a physical allergy, that mental obsession. My brain says, you know what, might as well. And then once I'm on, it's on. I do stuff like, it seems like it'd be a great idea to, after maybe getting my second DUI, and the next thing you know, here I am. I wake up 2 days later in the back of a pickup truck in San Luis Obispo, wearing a wetsuit. And even then, I wasn't drinking then. But when I was like 10, I forgot about this for a lot of years. Because when I was 10, I tried to commit suicide when I was 10. And the only way, and it's a good thing I was only 10, and the only example I had of a noose was on Westerns. I just visually saw that, but I couldn't really tie it right. So I don't know, you would have a different speaker up here if I could tie the knot right at 10 years old. I didn't even take a drink yet. So I know that my problem started way before alcohol was definitely probably the only thing that kept me alive, probably. I used to hear that in meetings. I didn't really understand that until I remembered that. And, but my child, everything was fine. My parents are still, we're actually this next month, they're celebrating, 50 years of marriage. And so I'm really a part of my family's lives these days. But to back up a little further is I drank, and near the end it was starting to become more of a daily thing. I started drinking more often in the morning because the hangovers would take longer to go away, and so I just started drinking more in the morning because then they would just go away. For me, at 2 room temperature beers, I started to purposely leave out beer to let them get room temperature, so in the morning I would have, they would be right there. And I thought that was normal. if I was to tell anybody that at work, they would just probably, I probably wouldn't work there anymore if I told them that. And I know things that that we think are funny, like failed suicide attempts that we think are funny. If I told people that at work, they, I don't know, yeah, really, I don't, I wouldn't tell people that at work. People just don't think that's funny. And, you know, like if I said, oh, I was 10, I tried to commit suicide, and I couldn't tie the rope knot right, so therefore, you know, they just don't think that's funny. The guy, he hasn't been, hasn't been around in a while, but the gentleman I knew, he would tell a failed attempt story. He was looking at his wrist like this, and he could just kind of losing consciousness, blood's flowing out onto the bathroom floor. And then he, the thought occurred to him that he's like, I never really did the steps honestly. And he told that, and all of a sudden the room just started laughing. And like, this guy's, it was at a mixed open meeting, and so this guy's wife, I looked, and she's not laughing, because she doesn't think it's funny, because she's not an alcoholic. So it's like, I mean, it takes work to be an alcoholic. You either are or you aren't. You know what I mean? You either are or you aren't. And so when I first got here, wasn't really sure. And so when I started hearing stories about just those things, you know, but I didn't relate to the guys who, or the people who flew planes under radar and through, you know, I don't know, under Florida. I didn't relate to that. Or they lost, like, houses and businesses and were married a bunch of times. And, you know, I just, to me, I would hear those and I go, maybe I'm not an alcoholic. You know, I never stored a fifth of vodka in the glove box. You know, I never did that. You know, I drink it. I didn't really have enough money to, like, have enough to store and stockpile. I'd usually do it right away. So it was those little tiny things I would try and key on. I'm not an alcoholic. Not an alcoholic. You know, but I know that what makes me an alcoholic is it centers in my mind, and then once I take that first drink, all of a sudden something happens. That phenomenon of craving kicks in, and it's on. And I'll go anywhere and do anything, no matter what the consequences were. You know, I totally relate to what the book says. You know, whatever happened to me a day, a week, or a month ago, I start drinking, all that's, I forget all that. You know, and so, and then things pile up on me. And of course, my drinking definitely made my life unmanageable, definitely. But it was the choice. Now I know it's the choices that I made physically sober that later put me in a position to be hurt later on. You know, it's like thirst step stuff you don't hear that much about. That self-centered stuff. Yeah, turn your will over. That's usually what you hear a lot. But really, it's that self-centered. I wanted to run the show all the time. Every time I had something going, I would get out of things or I'd talk my way out of it. And so I started to rely upon that kind of self-centered thinking, that willpower, so to speak. I got out of that one. I'll get out of this one. I'll get out of it. Don't worry, I'll talk to him. I'll handle it. And it would work a couple times. I'd walk a lot of people's toes. People would be mad at me, but still, I'd get out of it somehow. I'd weasel my way out of it. And so I lived on that, you know, trying to run the show. And that self-propulsion. And it just put me in these positions where just my world got very, very small. Through a series of events and court stuff and group counseling, I wound up at Alcoholics Anonymous. And probably one of the best things a counselor ever said to me, he's like, I can't do anything for your alcoholism, but you can come here until you feel better, but you should probably go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And this guy to me is like, Paul, why don't you take him to that noon meeting across town? So, and that's what Paul did. And why I stayed here, I don't know. You know, my second meeting ever was a meeting in Alameda on Oak Street. And an old courthouse. And that meeting was crazy. It was a room kind of like this, but they had those old benches around the sides that, like, folded down. And, like, it was an old courtroom. And the speaker was talking. And somebody showed up, like, 20 minutes into the meeting. And the secretary got up and ran to the back screaming to give her friend a hug. And even my second day in sobriety, I knew that something kind of not professional about it. Something not, like, like her job. Like, she left her post. Oh, my gosh, she's up at the front. And it just freaked me out. And I couldn't pay attention to the rest of the meeting. And then they were talking in the back. It was crazy. It was just a crazy meeting. And I'm pretty sure that meeting's not there anymore. So you know that saying of a meeting where everything goes, soon nobody goes? You know, it's time. I've seen a lot of meetings disappear because of they lose their purpose. They lose their focus. They get away from alcoholism and the business of helping other alcoholics get sober or carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I could forget that sometimes. I want to complain to you about my job. I want to complain to you about my relationship. I want to complain to you about all sorts of other things, which, you know, they are about alcoholism. But really when it comes down to it is, you know, am I helping another alcoholic? You know, what am I doing today to add to Alcoholics Anonymous? You know, and some days I do a horrible job of that. I'm a horrible member of Alcoholics Anonymous sometimes. I had dinner with my friend Dave, who lives out here, and I guess we saw another guy from in the fellowship. He's not in this room, but so we're going to talk about him. But the only way to really simplify is I could just tell that he doesn't come from the same kind of fellowship that I grew up in, or go to the same meetings that I continue to go to. And so an older me, even just maybe 3 years ago, I'd probably still be in that restaurant like debating something with him. But these days I go, you know what? He's entitled to that. That's okay. Live and let live. And I would see those like in the fellowship where I got sober. Live and let live. Think. One day at a time. I never really knew what those meant. And then especially the think one where they say, oh, my thinking, ooh, don't go in there. My mind's like a bad neighborhood. Don't go in there yourself. Don't think, you know. Think before you go. So it's like, well, then you want us to think? But then I realized that like not until like right around step 10 where it talks about, well, Sandy will have returned. You know, it doesn't happen in step 2. When I get to 10 somewhere, and I've already done most of my amends, and I'm doing 10 on a daily basis, then I start to have maybe some sane thoughts. I may be able to have some thoughts that at my job, they would actually go, good job. Good thinking. You know? And then I would, you know, hopefully I could stay right size. You know, so it's strange. I really, like those sayings, I really know they mean so much more to me now than they did, you know, early on. Like, especially, like, live and let live. Like, I have to let other people, they're entitled to their opinion. They're entitled to do whatever they do. I just know that I have to try and be an example, you know, and I do it horribly a lot. And at work, I do it horribly a lot. And I ruin it for maybe people who might need this program someday, you know. I try not to, but a lot of times I try and think of that is, what if this person has a problem with alcohol and I'm being not a very nice coworker right now? If in fact they ever need my help, would they ever want it? You know, a friend of mine who I haven't seen in a while, and he's kind of faded away a little bit, is he tells a story about a gentleman at his job needed to go to meetings. He said, "Hey, I heard you haven't drank. Can you take you're an AA? Can you take me to a meeting?" And he's like, "Oh man, I haven't been to a meeting in 8 years. I don't even know where he is." So he gets out the schedule, tries to look for a meeting. This guy finally, after hanging out with him for a couple of weeks, goes, "You know what, man? If sobriety is what you got going, I don't want to do what you guys do because you're miserable." You know, at the time he had 13 years of not drinking. So those kind of stories I remember. And where I stand today, 18 years away from a drink, I want to have it still fresh. I want it to still be alive. You know, Carolyn and I were talking before the meeting, and sometimes people who can just fade away and not do what we do, maybe they're not alcoholic, I don't know. But I need to keep coming here, and I need to keep giving what was freely given to me. You know, and without expecting a return. And because of that, so many wonderful things have happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous. There are some tragic things that happen along the way, but for the most part, I know that it's possible to go to college in sobriety. And I didn't do really well or anything, but I got it done. It took me a while to get that first one. And then I find myself going to graduate school twice. Which is, I mean, I'm the kind of guy where I did nothing in high school, and I found out on the last day of school that I was going to graduate. I was in the room, like, cleaning in my English teacher's room, and I was bringing stuff to her car, and I was, like, writing a paper for her, and she signed this thing, and I passed her class with, like, a D-minus-minus, you know? And that's my academic career. And so it's weird that I've had way more education than I would ever imagine. And the thing is, just the simple thing I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, I just follow direction. You know, getting a college degree, they have these classes, they're worth certain units, you take them in these areas, you just do it, you get a decent grade in it, and you move on. the rest of the world knows that. And all of a sudden, like 5.5 years sober, I'm like, oh my God, that's all you do? Really? You just do what they want you to do? I'm the kind of guy where I'd go into college, like in the earlier years of my college when I was having problems, I would go into that room and I would think that college professor, no, you don't know what you're talking about. No, you don't know what you're talking about. You know? There they are, they have a PhD in whatever that subject may be, and I'm sitting in there, it's my first week of that class, and I think they don't know what they're talking about. That's the kind of self-centered, self-righteousness that I have, that I come to the party with. And that plagued me for years, because you know what happens? Then I get a D, F in their class, or I find myself withdrawing, or they come up to me and say, you know what, you're not doing well, you might as well drop this class. Do you want me to do it for you, or do you just want to, you know? And so that happened a lot. I dropped a lot of classes in the very beginning. Because I just couldn't do it. But I know it's possible to go to meetings and still go to college at the same time. I know it's possible to work full time and go to school at night and still go to 3 meetings a week and be married. You know, when I first got my graduate degree, I just got married 2 weeks prior to school starting. So I know it's possible to get married in Alcoholics Anonymous, go to school, start something new, and still go to meetings, and still sponsor people, and still have commitments at meetings. It's possible. I see people all the time, they get married, and then all of a sudden, they're gone. Or they start a new job, and they're gone. And they start these other things, and they're gone. I could see that because I could do that too. I'm no better than they are. I could do it too. I could do it in a second. But I don't know what it is where I've been able to notice that and go, mental note to self. They got married, and I don't see them anymore. And then they drank again. My engagement date is, you know, September 9th. You better make sure I'm still going to meetings, you know. So, boom, boom, boom. Luckily, my wife, who's not an alcoholic, not luckily that she's not an alcoholic. I don't mean it that way. She's not an alcoholic. And she's pretty sane. And so I know that 4 days for me is about as long as she could take it for me not going to a meeting or not talking to somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because the first vacation we went on, it was pretty horrible for her. I don't know what the problem was, really. But on like the next vacation, she's like, so did you call the service center over in Hawaii to see where maybe they can send you a schedule or you can get a contact person, you can call and we get over there? Did you do that yet? And so, you know, I got the hint. So whenever we go somewhere, I make sure I find out prior to where the meetings are before we go. And usually you ask people in meetings, hopefully if you have a home group, I have a home group. If I go to a home group, I ask people in meetings, hey, I'm going to Ireland. Can you suggest any meetings? You know, at my home group, I could think of 5 people that, you know, go to Ireland quite a bit. And so get out of myself, pull my head out of my rear and go talk to them and figure that out. But for some reason, you know, for me, that's my alcoholism. I won't do that. You know, I won't ask for help when it's right in front of me. And so if anything, what I've learned over the years is how to ask for help. And even though 18 years away from a drink, I still have to ask for help. You know, there's still things I'm finding out. There's so many things of living life in sobriety that are being uncovered. And I don't like to use that term about the onion because I don't really... Layers. After a while, then the layers are gone. There's no more layers left. So I want something a little bit more permanent than an onion to uncover things. So I think where I'm at now, I've uncovered a couple of onions. You know, so I think there's just so many things that have happened. Lessons that I've learned and not learned in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, how to behave in a job. It's interesting where I work now. I work, I'm in the business of education. And it's really strange that I find myself there because here I am with this kid who, I stayed back in third grade. I was the kid that always on the report cards got like unsatisfactory. They'd always say Roger doesn't work or doesn't play well with other kids. Like I'd push kids off of like in the playground, I'd throw tan bark at them. I just could not be with other kids. I either wanted to be your friend or I didn't want you to be a friend. Or if you started to like me, then I would do something to like push you away. So there was never really like this healthy amount of being right here, right now. And even before I found alcohol. And so even now as an adult, years away from a drink, being armed with the tools of Alcoholics Anonymous, I still struggle, you know? And I think a lot of times now it's just because every day I wake up is not filled with rainbows and teddy bears and unicorns and flowers, that I'm not doing it wrong, you know? Some days it just feels crummy. And it doesn't mean I'm not doing Alcoholics Anonymous right. And that doesn't mean don't do anything. But I know that when I am active in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and I go to my set amount of meetings and I go to my home group and do my service commitments and take other men through these steps, through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I'm supposed to, because it's my duty as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. People in their first 90 days, it's interesting how we all clap for them. And something my sponsor said a while ago at a speaker meeting, which I could never repeat what he said. It's just, he does it and he can do it. I'm not like him. I'm not him. But the thing what he brings up is, oftentimes it's great. We do need newcomers and we're glad you're here and you need to keep coming. And we hope you keep coming back and get this thing. But the other is like, we were at the speaker meeting and there was five people that stood up. They had the sobriety countdown. Five people stood up for 40 years, and people clapped. Then there was a gentleman who had a day and a half, and they gave him a book, and then the whole room stood up, and they gave him a standing ovation. And so my sponsor got up there, and I didn't even know he was going to do, but I'm like, I can't believe he did. And I was just waiting for people to like start throwing chairs at him. But he just said, you know what? The four people that you barely clapped for, they've been keeping the doors open for the rest of you. And you give a standing ovation to someone who thinks it's a revolving door. And this gentleman definitely indicated that this wasn't his first time. I know today that I can't treat Alcoholics Anonymous like an emergency room. It's here, but I can't take advantage of it either and the people in it. I need to participate and somehow be a stable force in Alcoholics Anonymous and not come unglued all the time or be some ball of you know, unstable nerves. At some point, I gotta grow up in Alcoholics Anonymous. There's also that part, emotional sobriety. You know, I have to start becoming a decent human being in society. You know, and when I can do that, then I can participate in Alcoholics Anonymous in a way. I think that, you know, it's not an advanced AA or anything, but it's not. It's just I gotta keep doing more. You know, there's always more I can do. And for me, in the kind of work that I do, it's important that you always assess yourself and your performance on the job and what you're doing. My people are always coming up to you and say, okay, what could you do better? How did this thing work? You know, can you do it better? And so my brain works like that anyways. I'm trying to do, well, how can I do it better? You know, how can I be more efficient? There's times in my sobriety where maybe I was sponsoring five guys and I am on this kind of rant about something or I don't do something and all of a sudden there's a mass exodus. They're gone. You know, I have to evaluate that. Because you know what I used to do? I used to go, you know what? Screw them. They're going to drink anyways. They don't know what they're missing. They weren't serious about sobriety anyways. But what I have to do is I have to go, you know what? Maybe I didn't give them all my time. Maybe I didn't call them back soon enough. You know, I know I don't, like, I know some guys I sponsor think that I wait by the phone all day waiting for them to call. And when I don't call them back in like the next 2 minutes or I don't text them back in the next 2 minutes, they're like upset and they're indignant. And I don't even know they're upset until they avoid me at the meeting and they're, you know, they're like baboon ass, I think it's called. They're just like hurt. But I know today there's definitely more of a palatable way to approach things. And there's a time in my sobriety where I didn't really approach things that were that palatable. I mean, like mean or callous or terse, bristly. And I think that what I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous is in the business of maybe carrying this message to other men in Alcoholics Anonymous, especially ones that I sponsor, is I have to make adjustments to each person a little bit. But I have to get out of myself to even pay attention to what that is. Because I think a lot of times everybody's needs are a tiny bit different. We're all alcoholics and the steps are all the same. We all get shot out the other end, but the same process. But somebody may not appreciate me hanging up on them. Some guys, that's what they need is me to hang up on them. So I need to be aware of those things. So I'm always constantly assessing what I'm doing when I sponsor people, you know, because I don't want to have another mass exodus again, you know. I don't want to be a dictator in that, and I don't appreciate that, you know. And my sponsor now, he, back in the 80s and the 90s, he was kind of maybe referred to as that, but he's definitely softened up quite a bit over the years, and I appreciate that about him, because every time I call him, I think he's going to read me for something. And, you know, he just says, "Hey, Raj, how's it going?" And my late sponsor, Glenn L., I just watched that man live this program. And so I would ask him, "Why did you choose your sponsor?" And he'd say, "Well, because he's more active than I am." So when he passed away, it was just a no-brainer to choose his sponsor. As time goes on, it's kind of sad that maybe they all moved to Florida. I don't know, but there's just not that many. I'm sure there are probably pockets of them around, but as time goes on, there's just not as many old timers. Maybe they don't go out at night because they can't drive at night. But I know that's true. Actually, a lot, they just go to noon meetings and morning meetings because they can't drive. But I tell you what, though, if my sponsor was active, you know, people, you know, he got to places. People asked him to talk at conferences. People, you know, asked him to talk at little meetings. But he wasn't like a circuit speaker. You know, he was just a guy in AA who carried this message. And I guess that's all I want. And I watched at his funeral. We did it so it wasn't some gratuitous, you know, I knew him more than you did. If you've ever been to a funeral in AA before, anybody? And they're painful. Oh my God, you get somebody going up there and it's like, okay, we only have the church for 4 hours. But so we knew that. So all of us that were sponsored by him, we kind of talked about that. We knew that. So the two guys that were sponsored by him the longest were the only ones that went up there and said something. And then his sponsor went up there and said something. And then three men from his work industry came up there and said something. And the amazing thing was is the people that he worked with said the exact same things that people in AA did about him. And that's pretty amazing. I don't know if that makes me cry, but that's a hell of an example. And there's not many. You know, I think if we people talk about pillars, there's only three pillars in this room, or four if you count that one. So, for as big as AA is, I think we need more pillars in AA. So the story I told about my sponsor kind of reaming the crowd for clapping for the guy with a day and a half. The reason why I told that is because I want to thank the people that are, you know, sober 10 years plus that continue to show up to meetings and are active, and that you're sponsoring people and you're trying to do this in your life. You know, I need you. As you get older, sense of mortality. I'll end with this. I'll end early because I don't think I can muddle through this anymore. God, it's a good thing I'm not allergic to dogs. There's these two wonderful dogs in the front of the room. They're cute. And I'm Asian, so they're looking pretty tasty. Right now. I'm just kidding. I've never heard. See, I don't know if that's bad, but I, you know, use humor, deflect, give myself a little time. throw a little smoke bomb out there. Impose. But again, I just want to thank the committee. I mean, I just love Alcoholics Anonymous. I just absolutely love Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm the kind of guy in my home group or in and around where sometimes I get labeled as like the, you know, guy who's aggressive, or, you know, people are always afraid to talk to me, or when I share a meeting, they're like cringing because I might say something directly to them, how they're not working at, you know, doing the program right. And the thing is if you've ever met my wife, you know, sometimes I just, her and I, we hang out. It's like, if I was that much of an a-hole, my wife would not be hanging out with me. So a lot of times, you know, I have to check myself. And then the sad thing, but yet it's kind of cool, is, you know, I'm still here, you know. And sometimes, like to quote my late sponsor, Glenn Alley, he would just say, you know, kid, sometimes it's lonely carrying this message of Alcoholics Anonymous. So you got to get used to it. So if you're in this room and you feel like I feel, you know, we got to keep doing it. We got to do it better and harder. And if you're new in your first 90 days, I hope you find what I've found. Give yourself a chance. You know, I think if you're in this room and you raised your hand and you said you're an alcoholic, I think that's enough willingness. And I think the next thing is you owe it to yourself. You know, ask yourself, how is your life? And it is here. You can rebuild another life. You can be reborn. But you got to want to. Then you got to let us help you. And then you got to stay here. And it's not that hard. So I'm going to keep coming back. And I just want to thank our first 10-minute speaker. I forgot her name already. Mel Barissa. And the committee for having me talk tonight. Thanks.
I'd like to re-welcome the visitors and newcomers. And let's thank tonight's speaker again, Roger.
And Marissa.
Please help me close the meeting with the serenity prayer. God?
God, grant us serenity to accept the things that I cannot change, courage to change the things that I can,